Following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Got to mention in my earlier introduction of Brother Popte that earlier this year in February he received what's called in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition lamp transmission, which is like a Dharma teaching transmission from Thich Nhat Hanh, the teacher in this lineage. So it's a high honor and a real sort of nod to the practice of Brother Popte. When I asked Brother Popte to give a talk, he said, no. And have a discussion. I said, oh, that'd be great. People would probably love to hear a little bit about how they practice at the monastery, and people probably have lots of questions. So, thanks, Brother Popte.
So, feel free to ask your questions. There are some things I'm inclined to start talking about that I think are important. And, of course, while you're thinking of a question, just the simple meditation of seeing my father as a five-year-old, seeing my mother as a five-year-old. For me, a big learning as a Westerner has been to recognize how much I'm just the continuation of my blood ancestors and my spiritual ancestors, that I'm just a drop in the river, and that it's a good meditation in helping to get free of the Western preoccupation or of being a rugged individual, unique and important person with special qualities. And as Mark mentioned, Thich Nhat Hanh said that the reason he gave me the name Brother Phat Day, young brother, is because I used to be called Father Adrian. And I think he helped me right from the beginning know that even at 68, I'm a beginner. And even though I had originally met him in 1997, when my new fiancé persuaded me while we were in Holland celebrating our engagement at an old castle in Doorn with friends and relatives, it persuaded me to go down to Plum Village and have the experience of listening to Thay teach and meet the community at Plum Village, which we did. And we were so strongly impressed with it that we did come back to the Twin Cities and immediately began forming a small sangha of people gathering on a weekly basis, as do you, in the Plum Village tradition, Plum Village practice. And I think the Blooming Heart Sangha, not too far from here, is the continuation of that group. My partner and I then went in 2000 to California. We liked this practice so much that we collaborated with several others and formed a residential lay community practicing morning, noon, and night this mindfulness practice as a kind of like a lay monastery. And we did that above about 2,000 feet above San Barbara, and that was a wonderful experience, which evolved for me into 2 years later, or 3 years later, then asking Thich Nhat Hanh if I could be a monk with him. At which time he said, that's wonderful. He says, you give up your stocks and your bonds, your bank accounts and your houses and your cars. He knew I'd let go of my partner, my lover, and he said, you give up your theology. And you learn humility. So here I am. Now, having said those kinds of things, what questions might you have that I can respond to? Yes.
You know, prior to giving that up, I would imagine you would have authentically said at various points in your life that you had humility. I excuse myself, I had surgery this week on my mouth, so I'm not nervous. But that particular haunt asked to give that up, to have humility. How do you, I don't think compare, it's a simpler term, but how did you, I should, first of all, should ask, did you think in terms of humility back when you had these things and doing other stuff? And if you did, how does it compare, or how does it, what's your sense of humility with that background?
I'm hearing you asking me how I compare the humility that I've been learning as a monk with what I might have thought of as humility that I used to have. Well, I did think I was a fairly humble man. I think my assertiveness in a commitment to see that work got done and that the game was played well or that the job was carried out well tended to be interpreted by some people as being too pushy, too not humble. So, and I think that the monks were wary of approving me for ordination. By the way, so I wrote a letter. Thay said, wonderful. 3 months later, after I came back to California to complete a lot of things and let my former partner know for sure that I was on my way in a different direction, the community then had to vote on my letter to get into the community in June of 03. And I didn't know it at the time. I heard 3 years later that the community said, no, we want him to be an aspirant longer. They were wary of the stockbroker, businessman, former priest coming in to this rather, the Vietnamese culture still dominated the community, and so I was viewed, I think, as a candidate to become a monk. The community was wary of me, and so they had decided that it'd be several months before that would happen. But at the time, Thich Nhat Hanh said, "No, we're going to ordain him now." And it was a good thing because 10 months later, the community then set a limit of 50 years old for new people to get in. So in the following 10-12 months after I was ordained. And I learned, though, in the community, I had to, one of the big learnings for me was to let go of my work orientation, my tendency to be the general manager, to see that things get done, and to, my notion of humility before allowed me to be very preoccupied with the job getting done and making that more important than having harmony amongst the workers or the monks. And so it was an important learning that if I'm going to be the work coordinator, which I became a short time after becoming a monk, I needed to learn how, yes, it's important that we do work, but our objective is not to get the job done. The objective was to learn how to be mindful in every moment of the work, and that we do so in a manner that creates harmony amongst the workers. So, and so for me, that meant learning that, understanding that, seeing that, and then letting go of that habit energy of getting things done. And in that, It was like letting go of that my ideas are important, and letting go of that habit energy of wanting to control. And which means then I've also, to take it further, I have a tendency that I know a better way. That's one of our family habits. And that means that the people around us or with whom we're interacting, I'm fairly quick to suggest, you know, there's a better way to do that. Like being a coach, you know? And for me, it's been learning to recognize that I have that tendency, but to shut up and not inflict somebody with my better way. And with that, to look and to really accept what I see as their way is fine. And to support it. And to, we call the process of like complimenting, it's watering their flowers. So it's letting go of my prejudgments, watering the flowers. And in cases where I'm finding that I'm still feeling critical or there's something wrong here, learning to forgive. And that's been also part of the last couple of years of experience for me, more intentionally having an attitude of forgiving and recognizing that the judgments I'm making are just projections of mine, projections of my own guilt or self-criticism. And in doing that, I'm finding as I'm extending forgiveness, not always saying anything, just intentionally taking on that mind. And then looking for opportunities to, instead of suggesting how a guy can improve, a monk can improve, being aware of how to make a compliment for something they're doing, by the way, the meal they cooked, or the Dharma talk they gave, excuse me, last Sunday, that sort of thing. And I found a couple things happening. One is, gee, we seem to be enjoying each other more. And I find that I'm enjoying myself much more. I'm experiencing more joy. It comes from basically letting go. Next question. Yes?
I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more, if you talk about practicing in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh or teaching in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, I was wondering if you could say more about what that particularly means as opposed to another tradition.
Well, I'm very inexperienced in other traditions, but what's coming home to me ever more clearly is that it's good to learn Buddhist theory and Buddhist teaching and all the sutras, but that isn't what it's about. It's doing the practice. And a term that we're using a lot in Plum Village is called applied Buddhism. And that means for us, is making sure that in our relationships within the monastery, we are applying the teaching and the values of the importance of coming to understand, and to then out of understanding to really embrace one another in compassion and forgiveness. And we have some good support systems to do that, insofar as that once a week we have a happiness meeting. And so we circle up. There's only 15 of us monks, so once a week we circle up. And this is a time that we can just take a look at what our experience is and share what we like and what we don't like. But basically it turns out to be mostly a sharing of happiness and helping to acknowledge the happiness. Another practice we have that would be the alternate week is a beginning anew. And that's the meeting in which if we've got a grudge or a gripe or a complaint or a regret that we want to share with the community, that's for that meeting. Now, hopefully, if we've got a significant grudge or a complaint, it's better to do that one-on-one or maybe with a couple of us, you know, and not wait for the weekly meeting. But in the meeting, we'll go around, and the first thing we do in such a meeting is we water the flowers. Above all, I don't speak to you of a regret that I got or a complaint that I got unless I first acknowledge two or three things honestly that's really good about you. And by the way, when we do that, I notice is that, oh, I forgot or I didn't notice this about that particular brother, that there was something that this person's acknowledging. So by that kind of acknowledgement or watering of flowers, we begin to discover that there's a lot more flowers popping up and growing in this brotherhood than we were aware of during the past couple weeks. And then the next one is after you in many of the meetings there are no regrets or no complaints, but it is a sharing and acknowledgement. It's a compliment or a gratitude to one another. But then it might mean that I have to say I regret that I overslept and didn't show up for my cooking detail that morning or whatever. And normally that should have been done earlier, but it may be it's letting the group know too that I acknowledge that I didn't take care of my responsibility and I apologize for that. And then the third one, of course, is if there's something come up that two of us that we have a hard moment and disagreement, that we may then take care of it in the context of the group. And in this, in the last part, the training in nonviolent communication is helpful in learning good language and how to share about upsets without attacking or accusing the other person. a practice also is, you know, there's a conscious awareness that we're together. I feel very separate. Everybody looks different, and I have the old habit of looking around. Who would I include in my circle? The tendency to be comparing and all of that. It's a constant opportunity to work on complexes, you know, being superior or being feeling inferior or even the complex of being busy trying to figure out about equality. So the practice gives us plenty of opportunity to do that, but then in our working together, so we do all our own cooking. So we have a cooking team of two or three guys. We have and after the cooking, there's the wash-up team, and then at the end of the day, there's the team that does the cleaning the floors. There's various things like that. There's the landscape team, and there's teams that organize the retreats. And so that requires a fair amount of interaction and sense of collegiality and good workmanship together. There's also all of this is to build a sense of solidarity, and ultimately we call it interbeing. And one of the most difficult things for us Westerners is to really recognize in a heart felt living way that we're really just one. And to recognize that we're in this together, to recognize that as we're pursuing liberation from whatever it is, our anger or our fear or our jealousy or our greed, that this is not a solo trip. You do it together or you don't do it at all. And that's kind of news to me, the old Catholic that I am. And I used to teach certain things, but I never really got that in my experience of parish life and as a Catholic in the community. And so the sense of inner being, it's to have a collective energy. And we begin that in the morning at 5:45 when we chant, or we sit first. But the opening of the sitting, there's one of us gets up and we lead a chant The Dharma body is bringing morning light. And I see it as something that the person who does it better put out energy that gives a charge to everybody to bring us together to build the energy that, okay, gang, we're here now, and our job is to meditate. So sit up and meditate. But to do so in a way that we're aware that we're putting out an energy, a communal energy of so doing, supporting each other. And that's the way we start the day in meditation, but it should be the way we do everything. We eat in silence for the first 20 minutes, and that the whole idea is to both be aware of the food, but also aware of the comrades and sisters around us, and to be able to, without talking, acknowledge, look at. And for me, our practice of eating that way is a practice, again, that provides me what I look for. The old Catholic in me looks for in a Eucharistic community, and I have that in the community, in the way we eat. Is that helpful to give you somewhat of an idea? Now, an interesting thing about Thich Nhat Hanh, he never moves alone. He really does, well, he's such a famous speaker, and he'll give a two and a half hour talk that's being transmitted now worldwide. He does so with the clear awareness that he's just one. I mean, he's part of the Sangha body. And they wanted to have him come to Japan in May. And the Japanese organizers were very set on having this famous man come to Japan and give his famous talks. They didn't ever get it that with him comes 30, 40 monks. He comes as a Sangha. And when I said goodbye to him in New York 10 days ago, I was thanking him, and I complimented him on how inspiring he had been, this 85-year-old, day after day. And he reminded me, it's not him, it's the Sangha, it's the community. Yes?
Some of the writings that I've read of his talk about radical forgiveness for, really evil action, and a lot of it came out of the war. Is that still part of your teaching and your practice, or do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, he still is. It's peace begins with peace in oneself, and it's like and to me, he really lives. Jesus said, "I say to you, love those who persecute you, forgive them, love your enemies." That's been his behavior and his stance, I think, from the early 60s, very clearly. It's being peace, and he has not gotten engaged in getting out and doing strong protests. In fact, one of the comments, and you've probably read about it and heard it, when he did engage with Americans in the protest marches, like in the 60s in the U.S., he discovered, to his surprise, how many of the peacemakers, the protesters, were really quite violent and quite filled with anger in their heart and so on. And so, and for me, I feel like a beginner in learning that with him is that not only do I need to look at that person that I find offensive, almost like an enemy or an irritant. I'm not looking at a terrorist right now, but the same applies, is to be able to look at I think sometimes it's tougher to look at that monk that's in the next room to me, and to do that. But to be able to look at that person and to extend a heart of forgiveness for the suffering they cause, that's also so much a part of the suffering that's already in them. And that And then the next step is not just to forgive, but to send energy to wish them well, that they can flower in happiness. And that's truly what I see as the teaching here and feel as the teaching of time. Does that answer your point? Okay. Yes?
I'm curious, you mentioned giving up your partner, all of your belongings and all of your stuff and all. I understand that. I yet to understand what the teaching on partnership is with the celibacy and the codes. I feel like I can understand the differentiation, the distinction between a relationship or a partnership where you're codependent and gross in ego identification and attachment and using, you know, the other person to prove something right or something wrong about yourself, about the world. Like, there's definitely a distinction to be made, but I feel like I don't know where in the Buddhist tradition or in the Han's teachings there's direct advice or lots of maybe applied Buddhism in terms of partnerships and their sexuality. I sort of feel like often I'm left with this as an either or, like you either pursue your spiritual path or you can connect with people in the world. And I know that's not the kind of Han's teaching, but when it comes to
well, I'm inclined to share with you a couple of details about my experience and how I ended my partnership, and then to share with you what Thay is currently saying on all the retreats, and it's like particularly directed to married couples. And I'll try to be very quick about this. What happened to me was my wonderful partner surprised me with a request to separate and have space apart. And so I moved and lived in a different quarters than on the ranch. But I was very upset. I was very angry. And so we continued to work on things, and I continued also in a month's period to deal with a lot of grief and anger. It was like a shock to me. Something happened. At the end of the month, I couldn't believe it, but I felt relief. This is something, I just felt relief. And then in another month, I began to feel freedom that I hadn't been experiencing. And then in that month, I was reading The Life of Francis of Assisi by Kasantzakis. And I thought, wow, radical. I said, he was really something and building a new kind of monastic brotherhood. And I thought, wait, that's just like Thay. And then I moved to, I don't need more money. I don't need another romance. There's more in life. And I just had that sense that Thich Nhat Hanh has got it. And that's when I said, why not me? And I gave consideration to becoming a monk, canceled the trip to China, went to Plum Village for 30 days to check it out. After 30 days, I thought, yes, this is it. Now, my partner crashed. That and some other things happened. But she went through a huge, wonderful experience with journey work with Brandon Bays, and broke through and got in touch with, as she said to me afterwards, she said, I was blaming you for things that wasn't you weren't the cause. So what happened out of the upset of all that occurred, she broke through to something really wonderful and new in discovery in her life. We still love each other very much. In fact, 2 months ago, she wrote me an email and asked me to be the minister at her new wedding. I thought, that's terrific. I will. but I couldn't because we were on the plane going somewhere at the particular day that was to happen. Now, it turned out, I called on my way to the monastery then, after, now I've gone from October to January to March, I called a local Minneapolis astrologer who said in 1996 that she and I were such a wonderful match. She'd never seen it. 9 out of 10, the planets were in favor. So in March of 03, I said, look, I'm going to the monastery to be a monk. And she said, let me call you back. Called me back and she said, right on. It's time for you to go and learn how to take care of yourself. Now, I make this point because this is a very important part of our practice and teaching. Most of us grow up becoming pretty good at becoming caretakers and resenting them too. This is where women are most vulnerable to this, mothers. But most of us have not had good training on how to really take care of ourselves. Because it's only when we really learn how to take care of ourselves, really learn how to love the beloved, ourselves, that we will ever really have the capability that we need to be a great lover to our partner or to our children or to whomever. So for me, the Plum Village practice of mindfulness that I've been getting at the monastery has been a good dose of that, of learning how to take care of myself. And I think it's a good part of the reason I feel such joy in my life. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh these days is talking about the five mantras. Have any of you read about the five mantras in any of the readings of Thich? Well, the first mantra, see, he touches on how, and I had this problem even with my partner when I was a stockbroker, coming home and not really being present. Dads sometimes have difficulty really being present to their boy, willing to buy him anything, but to really be present and to play and to just be there. And my partner complained about that for a while in the relationship, that I'd come home, but I wasn't really present. My head is still in too much in the office or whatever. Well, Thay's approach to that is looking at it, and he tells a story about he giving a talk, and he noticed in the community there was a woman, she just kept crying. So after his talk, there was a couple from Bordeaux, and he knew them, and so he stepped over to him and he says, I think your flower needs watering. And the guy caught it, and so on his way home, he recognized that something had been missing on him, and so he really engaged and talked with and watered her flowers. When they got home, the reports came back. The kids were blown away. It was like a mother they hadn't seen before, a happy woman. And it was and the guy then reported back to Thay that it was a huge breakthrough in their relationship. Now, what he does in the retreats is he talks about the first mantra, being able to put forth the first mantra to your partner. And that is, darling, I'm here for you. You might even just do it from the office. Call back. And, darling, I'm here for you. And really mean it. And then another one is, darling, I know you are there. And it makes me very happy. The third mantra is, darling, I see you are suffering. Or it might be, darling, I'm suffering, please help. And the fourth mantra is engaged in doing it. It's saying, darling, I'm doing the best I can. But to really be able to take it as a simple practice. Now, this practice, there's a couple I know that really applies it. And one day a week, they stop and they drop other things and they just attend to their relationship. Can you imagine that? One day a week. they happen to be running, they happen to be an ex-monk and nun with us. Stefa Pien, who was my mentor in April of 2003, and they have, after 8 years, left the monastery and have formed a residential lay community in New Hampshire called Morning Sun. If you have, you may have heard of it. So if anybody wants to find a really wonderful experience of what a lay residential community experience can be like, check out Morning Sun in New Hampshire. We tried it in Santa Barbara, but we couldn't last. But this one here is solid gold. If I weren't a monk, I would be there with them in New Hampshire. Unless I really got to know Common Ground a lot better. Do I answer your question? Okay. Yes. Yes.
In your journey, you know, there's been multiple different or various endeavors, and a question that I have a lot is, you know, the question of, you know, one's purity and whether we continue to find ourselves or we continue to create ourselves. You know, in your journey, it sounds like you've gone in all these different directions. Now, do you look at that as is a path that created who you are today, or is a path that discovered who you really were internally?
I think I got it. And I'm a slow learner, so it took me a lot of learnings.
Yeah.
And I look back on all those things I did, whether it was priesthood, working with criminals in corrections, working in real estate, working as a stockbroker. I look back on them as learning experiences bringing me here and catching on finally that I didn't need to go anywhere. I'm already okay. And it's like and my habit energies that I inherited and grew up with, and being competitive and being productive, they definitely took over for part of my life there. And I look back now and I'm grateful. It took me a long time. And I'm catching on basically to Lin Chi's teaching. Lin Chi is the 9th century patriarch of our Zen practice. And he's the one that says, you know, stop chasing all over to find the Buddha. Come home to yourself, to your ordinary self. And learning to discover and to embrace my ordinary self and celebrate it with joy, rather than to be out there trying to get better at something, which I did spend a lot of my life attempting to do. Then she is also the one, I think, who said, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Because it's a fabrication of your own imagination that you're meeting. The Buddha is here. And for me, what brings me great joy is that in the learning of that, I also learning that Christ is here. The trip into the practice of mindfulness is bringing me home. And there's a part that I credit Lin Chi with about people. We have thinking of, like, for instance, some monks I see yet that are 30, 35 or still struggling about, is this it or is that it? Should I stay? Should I go? It's often like couples are, or in a courtship. It's like, I give Lin Chi credit with what's my philosophy is, just do it. Follow your heart. I think Nike appropriated that from Lin Chi. But the difficult thing for many of us is really to really come home to our heart and to have the courage to follow our heart. And for me, It's like when I had the meditation and I shared about, hello dad, you know, are you enjoying the sitting? Seeing my dad is 5 years old. I'm more and more aware in my life of how much my dad helped me, and I'm grateful to him, to early in my life, that, particularly when I was struggling as a priest. And I, you know, I was like, what am I going to go home and tell my parents, these devout Catholics, if I leave this? But I had that sense that, and I was, happened to be teaching at that time the college course in the gospel, and it was the story of how Jesus came out of the waters with John, and he heard the voice, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased. And I had that sense that my dad is in me, and it's that energy in me that has encouraged me to stand on my own 2 feet and be a free man. And it was that kind of sense that encouraged me, or gave me the courage to stand up to certain people in the hierarchy and all that and say, no, thank you. That's not me. And to follow my own heart. I kind of got off there. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
I'm very grateful for taking that on, his writings. I think he brought a lot of invigoration to mindfulness in America. I don't want this to come out wrong. It's going to come out a little askew, but when I read his books and listen to you, it's like everything is always phrased in the positive. And, you know, these pithy, really happy little sayings, like kids' songs all the time. You know, his books are filled with them. And, you know, it just seems way askew towards this boy and happiness. And, I mean, I wish I could run around throwing flowers and smiling. It seems out of balance. Now, you know, how do I become soft enough to let it sink in? Or is it just that maybe a different tradition is better for me? And there's a lot of pain in this, too, because I read it and, you know, part of me can recognize it, but my mind just thinks it's out of balance. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying life is ugly and horrible and I'm not morose, but I read his books and I kind of chuckle. I imagine Barney saying these slogans. You know, but I would like to have them sink in because there is definitely a sweetness too.
Yeah. Thank you. At times I felt that, thought that like you. Other people have looked at that and they refer to this practice that has a far clearer feminine energy in it than does most forms of Buddhism that I've heard about. And I have, like I said, I'm not very experienced, but I think it has a very gentle feminine quality. Some people have referred to us as kind of like Buddhism light. I'm inclined to say, look at that, because that there's a bit of upset or a bit of something about it that doesn't feel good or feel right. Is an invitation to really come home and into your own mind, into your own heart, and look at that. And then the other piece of that I would say is, come and live with us a while. You know, the real, how many of you have been on a 20-day or 30-day retreat? You have. I'm of a sense that one, you know, books are good. They can go along, and listening to talks are good. We Westerners are very prone to really get attracted to and caught up in the intellectual notion of Buddhism, and I think that those longer retreats are the way to also to break through. And the other part might be is to do like one of the retreats with us, with him, where you're hearing him every day. Have you done that yet? Heard him face to face? Because I also have a sense of him personally, that there's a man of steel, and of truth, no self, of really freedom, of ego, and of any sense of being special, and he also is very good at helping us get that. You know, it's like many of us would like to go and sit down and have a special session with Thay and then be able to tell people how we were there with him and gave him a hug and all that kind of thing. He really is very, very cool about not getting caught in that sort of thing and helping us to grow in our appreciation of no self and non-ego. Yeah, I'd like to have you come and spend some time with us. Deer Park is very congenial, especially in the next few months, when the January and February ice and snow get a little weary. Come on down. Yes.
So piggyback on what you're sharing. Well, first, thank you for sharing. And maybe more personal questioning along the same lines. I know that sometimes, especially in community life, and especially in community life in retreat, being around the same people every day, we can build up some very strong afflicted views that are not in line with reality. Yeah. Based on the people that are around us.
Yeah.
And having a setup whereby you're really doing practices over and over where you have to verbalize love, I'm assuming that sometimes that feels quite disingenuous. And sometimes I would expect myself that at some points in my community life, if I would have been expected to say, you know, I love these people, or bring out, you know, Barney talk, I would be very, very, it would be very, very difficult, and I would find some very strong inner turmoil, which is, you know, the afflicted mind grasping to my view of what's wrong with the people around me, essentially. And so I would see those two, that practice and that mind coming into very strong conflict and possibly being very beneficial within the practice. And I'm wondering if you've had that experience of having a breakdown or breakthrough, or however you might put it, or have you experienced others going through that? Or
I've experienced it. I need to experience it more. It happens, we do experience it in the monastery, but we need it much more, I think, than we're still learning. And we're still a very young community. I think it's a major challenge of building connectivity that's really honest and candid and nourishing, which requires a good bit of vulnerability. I'm kind of on a little mission at the time. There's a TED talk, you know what the TED talks are? On vulnerability. And I think it's just it's a gem about looking at the very much of the time the inability to really come together and to really, really deeply connect is the failure to really be vulnerable, to dare to be vulnerable. And I don't know if I can answer your question further than to say it's an ongoing process for us. And one of the reasons I'm still there is I'm finding more of the good, honest, nourishing interaction than I found anywhere else. Yes.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how sitting meditation plays into Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition. I know that it's a Zen tradition, and in Zen, and most of Zen that I'm aware of, besides the Thich Nhat Hanh branch of it, the sitting meditation seems to be quite important. And my wife, returning from a couple of retreats in Plum Village, has told me that there wasn't so much of it there, and it's raised my curiosity, so I ask.
Thank you. Sometimes I think Thich Nhat Hanh's foremost practice of mindfulness is walking meditation. in the community, sorry about that. I'm not used to this. In the community, it's almost like there's equal emphasis put on eating meditation, working meditation, and walking meditation. As on sitting. Some of our monks would like to have more sitting. It's like we do 45 minutes in the morning. And 45 minutes later in the day, actually half hour followed by chanting, which then becomes like on the cushion for an hour. But are you suggesting maybe that sitting meditation may be, and certainly is in other practices, a bigger piece of the practice? Some of the practices nearest is a Daidong, a Triplong monastery that they do several hours a day, 2 hours at a time. That's not us. And we have the option to go down to the meditation hall early and sit an additional time if we like. Is there another question? Yes.
I almost hesitate asking this, but from my own personal perception of my own practice, sometimes I see it as just wandering about from tradition to tradition, from not being very disciplined in applying one particular technique or not. I don't know, I tend to sometimes notice that I don't think I apply a lot of judgment towards myself regarding that, but I was just wondering what your thoughts about that maybe.
Well, we're given to, we're good mall shoppers, that's our culture, and I think there's an awful lot of that. And it results also in a failure to really then settle in and go deep inner practice. What is it? The car salespeople call it tire kickers. People who just kind of come around and they talk like they're going to buy in, but not really committed. That's a danger. And on that particular subject, I think I would recommend that anybody like coming here to Common Ground will attempt, if they can, to get a very strong connection with Mark, and or somewhere others finding a mentor within the community that one can meet with periodically to look at one's aspirations and how I'm doing. I even did this as a stockbroker. I'd find another person and say, okay, this month my target is to do X million dollars this is my aspiration, my commitment. And then to periodically over the month meet with this other guy and talk about how it's going and to get feedback, but also to do it in a way that does not produce guilt, like or a sense of focusing on the failures, but mainly is to focus on moving forward and growing. And what I do in our practice, in some is in the various cities, is encourage people to do that, to find somebody that they think could be a good co-mentor, and make an agreement to periodically meet. And then the other piece is to express and to clarify, what is my aspiration this month? Is it to improve my communications with my wife or my children, or to improve my sitting, or to improve my capacity to forgive, particularly those certain people that irritate me? But to be specific and to as to one's aspirations, and thereby also avoid superficial kind of approach to the many different practices. There is a book out that my daughter gave me that's brutal in addressing this issue. Have any of you ever heard of Scott McKenna, or Jed McKenna in Spiritual Warfare? Jed McKenna in Spiritual Warfare. It's written like it comes out of a farm in Iowa, like a sangha. Yeah, yeah. But it's very, it really is very, very clear on confronting the tendency for people to engage in popularized Buddhism. And kind of fadism, and turns it into too much of fadism. It's a very good read. He's got three books: Spiritual Warfare, Spiritually Incorrect, I can't remember the last one. My daughter has become, in her own way, one of my number one mentors. There's a question over here. Okay. Yes.
You mentioned a couple of times, you gave a reference to the West or Western phenomena.
Reference
Western
to?
Western culture.
Yeah.
Western culture,
yes.
Or Western phenomena. And Thich Nhat Hanh's practice being from Vietnam and other practices from the East. And this practice of engaged Buddhism, how do we see that, or how do you see that, living in a society which is changing ethnically, economically, you know, more and more people are getting poorer. So how does engaged Buddhism informs or helps people who are not privileged in the society?
Well, the engaged Buddhism that he began and was involved in 1961 and 2 was recognized that the Buddhist monks needed to get off the cushions and get out there in the bombed out villages and help people recover their homes and their clinics and their schools. And then they formed the students for social action, and then also the order of interbeings from them, for people to really, at that particular time, the engagement was how to deal with the suffering coming from the war. But I see that there's an engagement, and social engagement is a very strong legacy of our own Western Christian tradition, and I sense that some of the things you share, this community is also engaged, whether putting out efforts, both maybe financially as well as physically, emotionally, in particular endeavors, whether it's to homeless or to whether in its needs here in America or in another continent. And what as you were asking the question, I remember Tai was being interviewed in Taipei by some pretty sophisticated people, and they were trying to take him up into rather strong theoretical questions on this television interview, and he brought them right back to apply Buddhism in their own personal lives and in their own relationships. And he's very simple and clear about that, is in terms of applied Buddhism is making sure that we are taking the teaching of the Buddha and it's operational in our relationship with our partners or with our children or with our workmates. And in many ways, I think that's the field for real development amongst all of us, is to take and bring engaged Buddhism into the marketplace in which we live, the schools in which we're working and teaching. And by the way, on that, it's kind of a segue, quite a number of areas in the world are picking up the mindfulness practice that we do and taking it into the schools. It's fairly well established in Hong Kong. It's now being established in Germany. Governor Brown is looking at how to take it into the schools of California, and we're producing the mindfulness practice teaching in books without Buddhist terminology. So it's textbooks in mindfulness practice without Buddhist terminology, and that's a big effort that's going on right now. Yes.
Are those being made available in the United States?
Yes, they are, but I couldn't tell you where to go right now for it. And it's still very early in the development, the preprint copies coming out for scrutiny and evaluation. An inquiry to Plum Village or even to us, we can ultimately put you in touch with the people that are engaged in that. We're 4 minutes over, I think.
Yeah, it's a good time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brother Pathe, for being here. And if people would like to support Brother Pathe and the Deer Park Monastery, you can leave a donation. Most of you know when we have guest teachers, we offer 55% of the donations to the guest teacher and keep the rest to support the center and its operation. And a number of programs are coming up. Rita Gross will be teaching a Buddhist history course, a Buddhist history for practitioners, starting Tuesday night, 4 Tuesdays. You can still sign up for that. Half-day retreat next weekend, and a day long later in the month, and a number of other programs. I think Craig is teaching a half-day mindfulness in the 12-step retreat this Sunday, 1 to 5, I believe it is. There's still space for that. So please take a newsletter with you if you're new to the center and look at the program, see what might make sense. Feel free to come up and ask questions if you do have any questions.
Could I add one more thing?
Sure.
Tai has been touched me to be busier than I have been reaching out to Westerners. He said, I didn't come to the West to convert the West to Buddhism, but to help the West get in touch with their own spiritual roots. And he's been pressing me to be more active in that. and then the recent retreats we did with quite a response. How many of you have Christian roots? Okay. I would recommend a book to you so we can have no more comment. And the book is, Without the Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian. It is a superb work by a Catholic theologian, but would work for Lutherans and Methodists and I think even non-Christians. Without the Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian. And I found it a very helpful and powerful piece. And then secondly, those of us will have to recognize in this that maybe the Christianity that we thought was the true teaching of Jesus ain't the real thing. And it means that we would have to come to deal with, and here's where Buddhism really helps, the tendency to dualistic thinking. And it's part and parcel of our Western culture, and it has taken over most of Christian theology. Dualism. And it can only mean one thing as we move and learn to deal with this with the help of Buddhism. It's going to give us a chance to really have an authentic, life-giving connection with our roots. I'll leave you with that.
Thanks for coming, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.